As expected, the third talk on these three characteristics is about not self. Some people will explain what not self is. Some people will ask, what is this not self? But maybe that's not quite the right questions. Rather, what is the function of not-self? What's the process of this insight into not-self? How is it part of this process of the path, the process of practice? How does it work, not-self? And some people content themselves with knowing what it is. But I don't know if it's a what kind of thing. Some spiritual traditions and some people find it very profound, the question, who am I? Some people, some practices are specialized in asking that question over and over again. And generally, the function of that question, if you ask it over and over again, more often than not, is to realize what you're not. So what then are we? What are you? Me? And it's a reasonable question to ask. And in my understanding of the Buddha's teaching, the Dharma, it's kind of not a very interesting question for the purpose of the path and practice. Or to say it in a more personal way, it's not so interesting to answer who or what are you. If what you want is to discover freedom from dukkha, so that's very different than how most of us are oriented and many people in our lives, where the self, me, my experience, my history is paramount. But our history and what is kind of yours and your experience is important. It's part of it. So how do we live in the fullness of this life? How do we live in the emptiness of this life? What's the interplay between fullness and emptiness? So, what comes through in the fullness of life is situational. My mother died just a few days ago, Monday night. And so I'm letting my heart and mind do what it feels like it needs to do in that context. I don't have a plan. I don't know what it's supposed to be doing exactly, except I think that it's important to give space for it to do what it needs to do. So I told you, I went for a long walk in the hills alone, because that was my way of making that space and time. And so the fullness of it all comes through easily. Somehow just a little surprised by it, some of the things that come. And I did some intentional thing of actually staying focused on remembering all kinds of memories I had of my mother. I felt it was important to kind of stay close to that. So that was kind of my effort. But it's also what just came as a result. The memories that came, the situation that came. And I was a little surprised to see how much my mind went back to a world that doesn't exist anymore. A world that in some way is unique to me or unique to my family, my grandparents and my mother's grandparents, who I knew. And this small city and coastal town of Norway, which, where I was born, and that long, you know, 50, 60 years ago, were all these things that happened that touched me and filled me and part of me and shaped me. And those people no longer are there. That world is no longer there. You can't go back there to that town. And like the same cobblestones are there. The wharfs are there. The church I was baptized in is there. I don't remember, though, that, but it was pointed out to me. I went back for my sister's baptism, and I don't remember being in the church. I just remember running around on top of the graves, playing. And so the people I knew, and then, you know, just the stories my mom told about her life before I was born came back, and the people that she knew, and then talking with my aunt in Norway yesterday morning, learning more things about my mom that I never knew. So these thoughts and memories and ideas are coming up. And it just feels like part of the fullness of it all. I see then also in the process of these things, and that I was shaped by a lot of this. And who I am today is partly a result of many of those things that happened in that world that is that who I am? How I've been shaped? I've known my grandfather, my great-grandparents, or I've met them all. I don't remember meeting them all, but I met a number of them, and I've known now 5 generations of Fransdal men. My great-grandfather, my grandfather, my father, myself, and my sons. And there seems to be something a little bit in common in these that I've seen 5 generations. Is that nurture or nature? Is it Fransdal genes? Is it Fransdal culture? What is it? And is this me? Is this who I, you know, who am I? What am I? Shaped by all these things. I continue to be shaped. I continue to be influenced and conditioned and morphed. And I can watch it. I've watched it The more sensitive I got in practice and more I practiced, the more I could watch and see how something inside of me was changed, morphed, and how much my sense of self and who I am and it was a construct and something that was made up from a culture and in ways that I would never have imagined when I was younger. And then when my first son was, I don't know, just two and a half years old or something, I could see that I was passing it on to him. The notion, idea of what it means to be a self in this world, by how I talked to him and treated him and I think in some ways every generation does that to the next generation, but I could see it. And I said, well, should I not do this? How do I not do it? It kind of fits the cultures he's going to be living in, so it's functional. If I do something radically different, maybe it would work out, but maybe not. And it just seemed like the natural thing to do. I didn't feel like it was wrong, but it felt very important to see it, to understand the process of shaping and being influenced. And I think this is one of the things that I value so much about this Vipassana practice, is that to sit like on retreat like this, from time to time, it's a radical deconstruction process. We're kind of letting go, or if you don't like letting go, just settling. Or if you don't like settling, just being. And all the layers of the onion fall off as you do that. So this deconstruction process, and then when you get really quiet and still, and the influences of our family, society, culture, the ways that we've been shaped by things and by experiences and difficult and wonderful experiences, all these things that are kind of constructs or kind of the activity that the mind has created for who we are, to go through these layers and go below what people on ordinary street have no idea. They think this is who I am innately. But to see it kind of shed and get quieter and stiller, and it's not needed. Place where it's not necessary. A place where it just feels so healthy to not have all these constructs and ideas and who I am and what I should be and what I should do. To have them not operate there and find that it's a place of health, stillness, and quiet. And then from there, to watch the constructions start again, to watch the reintroduction of ideas and values and concepts of what it means to be a human being and what it means to be a human in relationship to others. And we start seeing that these things that we take for granted as beings built into the fabric of the universe, like this, isn't this the most natural way to be? They're all constructions. So seeing that with, passing on some notion of what it means to be a self to my son, I introduced him, I tried to introduce him to Buddhism as he was growing up, not to make him a Buddhist, but so that from whatever difficulties he encountered and how he was shaped and formed, that when he was older, he maybe would know where to go to get help. So this process of deconstruction, this settling, quieting that happens, the shedding, I think all of you have been part of a shedding process here. That's a lot of a good number probably of some worldly concerns out there and ideas of what you have to do or who you are in relationship to other people. And maybe you've gotten quieter here and some have been temporarily forgotten until I just reminded you. Sorry. And so, in the quiet, if we use that as a reference point, say you're as quiet or as peaceful as you maybe have ever been in your life, still. And then to watch the arising of a thought. And so I see arising of thoughts about a coastal town in Norway and a family and people and what they did during World War II and what happened in that country in the 50s and 60s and trips in a little motorboat to a little red coastal fisherman's two-story teeny house for vacations, rowing out on the sea and with other kids and encountering a whale 2 meters from the boat. All these things, I mean, so as they come through, and so as they do, I just feel like it's part of the fullness of life, given my mom just died and living with it. And I leave it like that, very simple. Occasionally I can see a little idea form like, oh, maybe I'm supposed to do it differently. Maybe I should somehow be different. Maybe I didn't do it right. Maybe people need to know that that's where I really am. That part of who I am back then, you know. There's always little, there can be teen little movements of, or big movements of making something out of it, constructing something out of it, adding more than just the wafting up of stories, wafting up of the feelings of the heart. I can put it together into an idea, this is who I am. I'm happy to say it's who I am, parts of it. I mean, all this is part of me. It's not part of you. But most of you haven't been to a small town in coastal town in Norway. So certain things are unique here. And it's my mom. You know, so this is all part of my world. But there's a difference between having it waft up, float up like a nice smell or something, and then appropriating it or claiming it or resisting it or using it to reflect back on something about who I am. This means that I'm was a good son. This means I was a bad son. This means that I should have. This means that I could have. This means that I better. You know, but just these things just arise in the fullness of it, and I don't have to make anything out of it. So as we come as from the stillness, whatever stillness we have, our practice, our clarity we have, we can see that when we start making something out of it, and sometimes it's obvious, oh, look, there I am, I'm doing it again. I've done it 10,000 times before, and I guess I've become an expert after 10,000 times attaching in this way or taking a stand in this kind of being this kind of person. But, you know, but to see it happen and see where did that come from? And how did this attachment waft up? Where did it arise from? And why should I give it any authority? Why should I believe it? Why do I have to get involved? So the function of practice is to start asking these kinds of questions. Things occur, and what is our relationship to them? And one of the relationships we can have is we use it in some way or other to measure ourselves, to define ourselves, to criticize ourselves. And if then our society helps us with that. I mean, some people, you know, it's hard sometimes to be not playing the self game. When I lived with a couple of friends when I was about 20, I think. And that's when I started meditating every day. I was going to, that was the plan. And I'd go to breakfast after meditating with my friends, and I felt really content and felt happy just to sit there and not say anything. But they were expecting the usual guilt to be there at breakfast, and it was very awkward. And in my young mind, I thought, well, I either have to give up meditation or give up my friends. Because I couldn't didn't figure out how to navigate the two. So I gave up meditation for about 6 months while I was living with them. And then some years later, one of the reasons I went to live at San Francisco Zen Center was because of every time I went there, I appreciated how the people there were not participating in my self games. My friends were all kind of, you know, I kind of had figured out how to, you know, play the self games, you know, and get feedback and support or all these things back and forth. But there were people in the center weren't participating. And so they were like, they became mirrors so I could see what I was doing in a way that I'd never been around people who were mirrors that way. And I wanted to go back there to have that mirroring. Because I really wanted to see what I was doing, what was happening here. But then as I started more and more meditation, and even more when I started doing Vipassana practice, I discovered a remarkable feedback that didn't require other people. And that is, it's one thing for memories that come waft up. It's another thing to grasp onto them. And the grasping on is simply an ouch. Ouch. And I got to see how much of the self-game, the self-construction, the self-definition, it's just one more ouch, ouch. Proving ourselves, ouch. Explaining ourselves too much to other people. Feeling in myself, what that's an ouch there. There's stress, there's tension, there's pressure. There's wanting something and really wanting it hard. I saw, for example, how much I wanted people to like me. And after a while, I could feel so acutely, ouch. Ouch, this really is stressful. I think I came to the conclusion, I recommend it. If you like, you know, grand conclusions, theories of the universe that be helpful. And that is that it's hopeless to try to get everyone to like you. It's a hopeless task. Don't try. Everyone is too much. So I learned that through a lot of ouch. But what supported me in that is both in seeing the ouch and being able to not be so caught in it and not be so involved in it was I was meditating a lot. And the sense of well-being, stability, confidence that came with the meditation showed me a different way of being. Showed me that there's a way of being in the fullness of things that feels very satisfying, very meaningful, without needing to play those games or without needing to get affirmation from other people or support from other people. So the combination of seeing the ouch and having the ah, they worked out really well for me in helping something grow, both grow and let go. And I got to, over time, appreciate more and more and more what I'm calling today the wafting up of impulses, thoughts, motivations, feelings. That I don't necessarily know where they came from, where they come from, but they seem to come partly in response to the world, right? The world I walk through. And I learned to trust. That world that appears without the ouch of self, without the ouch of me, myself, and mine. So the function of this not self-teaching is to save you from a lot of ouches. Save you from a lot of extra expenditure of energy. Most of these self games or self constructions we're doing takes a lot of energy, a lot of work to maintain it, keep it going, make sure that everyone else knows their role and participates appropriately. They have to listen to us tell our stories and explain to them why things are the way they are and defend ourselves. And because the construction of self that people get attached to and hold on to isn't just hermetically sealed just me inside of me. It kind of spills over into wanting others to see us that way, participate in the same thing. And approve of us and not disapprove of us. So it's this whole thing that goes on. But what if we don't construct so much self? Maybe there's the fullness of experience, and there's the emptiness of it all. In the fullness, there's the emptiness of defining it by the control tower. Defining it by some mysterious black box inside of us that feels tight or constricted or feels solid or where is that sense of self for you? There's not a few people for whom the sense that I am myself or something lives in the world of their thinking. I think therefore I am is not just a philosophical idea, but is also, I think, very real for many people. That's partly why their thoughts have so much value and importance and power, because that's where I find myself. The stories I tell. And I think it's why some people find it very frightening to have their mind quiet without thoughts, because then they don't exist. Or is it in your feelings, your emotions? Is it your body? Is it your desires and aversions? Is there a locus? Is there a location? Is there a contraction? Is there some place where that construction and that self-referencing, referencing exists for you? So this deconstruction process, one way of understanding it, there's these three characteristics. So there is, we start seeing that changing nature of it all. Change is not solid. Change is what's fluid. To see things coming and going and shifting and changing all the time, it begins loosening up the idea of solidity that's often associated with self, me, myself, and mine, who I am. When I remember one place that got solidified with me, it was felt like I had a door in my heart that I didn't know I had it yet. Until one day when I was maybe 15, it just snapped shut. Something happened, and I wasn't going to show that part to anyone again. And it was only about many years later, as I started to do my Zen practice, that door opened up again. And so who I was, in a sense, at that point, was the solidity of this closed heart. And that's what everything bumped up against that. And once that door opened, it's kind of cool. It doesn't bump into anything. The world doesn't run into it. It's kind of like it's an open door. And from the outside, it takes you outside. Everything just goes right through. So where is that self? Is it where you've been wounded and hurt? Is it where you've been in what you've been told you're supposed to do? So it's all these places, so what is it? But as we start seeing the impermanence, the changing nature of it, slowly this becomes clear. Maybe not intellectually clear, so we understand exactly what's going on, but where the holding is, where the freezing is, where the tightening is, begins to loosen. We run into it, we run into it, run into it. And that's part of the function of this practice, is to run into it, see it. And it means that sometimes we're feeling like meditating, we're feeling like, wow, it's so peaceful and calm. I have it made. This is it. And then you come back for the next sitting. What happened? You know, like, well, I'm not, I just suddenly regressed. I'm back at square one. What happened? Like, what did I do wrong? Did I have too much tea or use the wrong bathroom or what happened? But it often works that way, that we come into one layer where things are peaceful. It's almost like that opens the door for the next layer, that it's not going backwards, it's going forward, but now you have to deal with the, you know, the agitation, the challenges of the next layer. And so you do that, and then, so it's often kind of this practice. It's not like a linear practice from better, 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 like, you know, just like we're here to bliss out. It's something very real about this process of meeting ourselves and seeing it and going through this and being willing to show up for what's difficult, because that's where we start seeing and growing and shedding and coming to terms with some of these attachments to self that I think is so deeply ingrown. So we see the impermanence of it all, and changing nature, the inconstant. And the more we can see that, the more we see the subtlety of holding on to self, clinging to self. And subtle doesn't mean inconsequential. It means we eventually we get down to the subtlest layer, which is actually the most consequential, the place where, like, the root from which it all kind of comes from. And it can be as simple and innocent as a very subtle, even pleasant, kind of sense or feeling of emptiness. It might be such a sense of I am, that simple. No third word, you know, I am, whatever, just I am. And it can be more subtle, and even the word I disappears, just emptiness. But even that is kind of taken, although that's who I am. And so, but all of these kind of holding on constructs, defining ourselves by it, I kind of understand it all to be wind drag. It just slows everything down. It just kind of, it's a kind of resistance. It's a kind of, there's a Buddhist idea that conceit is like a flag. I think what they had in mind in the ancient world was a military flag that the opposing forces that show up with their big banner, their flag, you know, their country and all that. And, but that was just like the obvious target for the opposing team, the opposing army. So, you know, conceit is like, you have this flag up and the world will somehow, you know, be after it, I guess, or something. And I think of it more as if you have a door that's closed and you throw a baseball at it, which if you have in like 9-year-old American boys of certain type, that's what happens inside the house. And big bang against the door, you know, the door stops it. And if the door had feelings, it would hurt the door. But then if you open the door, The ball just goes right through. And so where does the world strike? What does it hit in you? What's closed? And what is it that can be put down and the world can just be there? Everything can be there. The fullness of it. The fullness of it all is great. So we kind of, so as we see the changing nature of it all, we see the ouch of holding on and clinging and defining ourselves, and all the ouches related to self, and all the ahs that can happen when that's not there. And so the function of this not-self teaching is to see how the changing nature and the ouches of life come with our sense of self. Not every idea of self, not every concept of self that we can have. We have lots of them that are innocent, lots of them that waft up and are there. That, you know, that can operate just fine. But it's the grasping, the holding onto it that limits us, that limit how we box it in or create limitations. And so the function of the not-self teaching is to see the ouch around self. And if that can be shed or quieted or let go of, or not believed, not participated in, not reacted to, then there's a room for the fullness of life, fullness of us. And I think that's very respectful of who we are. Kind of to get out of our own way, the way that attachments and clinging interferes with our fullness. And it's not just our fullness, but also the fullness of this world, where fullness and emptiness coexist. The emptiness of, empty of clinging, empty of attachment. Just the fullness of that, the whole show operating. And to trust that, I think, is one of the most remarkable possibilities of human life. And our societies don't know about trusting this. And we don't get a lot of support for it. We're expected, and people want us to be attached. They don't say it that way, but they said, you know, it's kind of the consequence of what they're saying. Like, you should be angry. You should be upset. You should want. I remember when many years ago, I went to a car dealership thinking about maybe buying a car. And I think it was probably the most bottom, I think it was a Honda, it was like bottom of the cheapest Honda you can buy there. And the dealer I went for a drive with the dealer, and he said to me, "You deserve an air conditioner." I kind of like, what? Where did that come from? Should I put this on now? Should I imbibe the poison? Yes, I deserve. I'm a deserving person. Now I know who I am. I've been searching for myself for years, and and who knew the car dealer would finally tell me? So this not-self idea, the function and what it's about is something to be very tender towards, respectful for, to be very careful that you enter into it with clear mindfulness, really see what's there. This is not a teaching that you're supposed to believe in and then apply it, you know, wherever you see, no self, no self, not that. That's probably just like really thick self operating if you're doing it that way. The idea is to be very respectful of all of this. Who knows why it's here? Who knows why you're attached and what's behind it and what's going on? Who knows where the self that you have was constructed and made? But at the same time, have a lot of respect and care and take your time, but really look at it deeply. But at the same time, be very careful that you're not justifying it, that you're not automatically defending it or insisting on it, which is also not respectful. Just be able to see, be present, and really look and understand and see what's going on here. And maybe you'll go through layers. Some of them are cultural layers. Some of them are familial from family layers. Some of them are personal layers. And some of them are religious layers. If you've been around Buddhism, some of us have probably taken on Buddhist ideas of self. Like if you're a good Buddhist, you should have a lot of metta. That's the kind of person you should be. And so you have to also kind of work through that. And then, you know, kind of settle and quiet into the fullness of it all, the emptiness of it all. So that you can be free. Free of attachments. Free of ouch. Free to allow the impermanent changing nature of our life to flow through us in the fullness of what it is. In whatever way it comes. And just maybe one day you'll understand that there's something very profound in realizing that just to be alive is enough. Maybe sitting here on retreat, breathing, walking, being mindful, entering into the living moment, where time lives, or where lived time exists, here and now. Where there's no need for it to be any different than how it is. And the constructions have gotten quieter. And it feels like enough to be alive, breathing, sensing, being aware. Tracking when the ouches arise and where the ah is found. The ah that comes from the absence of clinging. Thank you.